Anybody know if there's some sort of allergens in the air in particular? Is it just pollen or is it pollen or? That's it, dust from your house? I'm usually an October guy for allergy problems. The spring generally doesn't bother me too much. But my doctor thinks it's humorous that in my records for about the past 10 years, every October I'm in there with a sinus infection. He has a warped sense of humor, evidently. But looks like VBS has come to an end, and a lot of work went into that. And for all of you who were involved, it is appreciated. It does not go unnoticed. There's not a lot of pats on the back, probably, but certainly it's recognized by those who are paying attention, and the Lord recognizes it. So thank you for all your hard work. We're in 1 Kings chapter 1. How far we get, I don't know. I had plans of running through this sort of at breakneck speed in some way. But there's so much that I'm going to play it by ear a little bit and see how it goes. And then if need be, we'll pick up the pace. If need not, we won't. Or won't. Last week we gave a 1 and 2 Kings outline. And I think that we're going to run with it through these books. When we get to 2 Kings, if we get that far, if the Lord wills, we'll bounce back and forth when necessary between the Kings and the Chronicles. But we'll spend the primary moments of our study together in Kings. That doesn't mean Chronicles isn't important. But I think we can study 1 and 2 Kings and look at the differences. When something's said, for instance, in the Kings, you might read of the disobedience of a certain king, and you think, well, he's just no good, never was, but the Chronicles will record maybe repentance on his behalf. So you have to look at both accounts to get the whole picture. And this is the outline we gave last week. I think it's a good one. Of course, it's not original with me. If it were, I wouldn't have said it. I think it's a good one. But I do think it's helpful. It really describes what's going on. The first 11 chapters of 1 Kings, we'll refer to that as the Golden Age. The Golden Age of Israel. And when the Jews looked back fondly in history during the days of Jesus and thought about when the kingdom was at its most glorious point, this is the time period they thought about. First 11 chapters of the book of 1 Kings. It's also recorded in the first nine or so chapters of 2 Chronicles. But the Golden Age, Solomon's reign, is really where the United Kingdom reached its apex. And then beginning in chapter 12, and going through 2 Kings 17, we have the torn kingdom. God's people are going to experience civil unrest, and they're going to divide. They will become two nations, northern Israel, or Ephraim, and Judah. And so what went on during that time period is described in those chapters. And then 2 Kings 18 to 25, we have the last days of Judah. The last days of Judah. So where are we at the moment in our discussion? Just starting, we're in the Golden Age. 2 Kings ends David's reign and starts with, of course, Solomon. Keep your place marked and turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 22. This is important. And we'll come back to 1 Kings 1 in a moment. But this kind of sets the stage for us. If I were to ask you, who's the key character in Israel's history, who would you say it was or is? Okay, David, anybody want to else? Anybody want to offer another guess? Moses, that's a good guess. David, Moses, both Moses really sort of symbolizing the the period of the giving of the law and so forth, and the commencement of a nation and the Exodus. David, the United Kingdom, the family of David, the Messiah would come. Anything else? Solomon, maybe? All of those characters are key, there's no doubt. But here's what we need to remember when we come to a study of the history of Israel. Is it about, if we go back to the beginning of the historical books, we go back to Joshua, is it about Joshua? Is he a character, a key one? Sure he is. The judges, are they important? Their stories, absolutely. The very personalities involved, do they teach us certain things? Well, surely they do. And what about Ruth? Absolutely. Or we could talk about Saul and his position and place and the scheme of things, and then David and now Solomon. And we could reference a number of other important personalities in the Old Testament that we learn a lot from. But what we need to remember is when we study our Old Testament, well, actually, the Bible as a whole, your key character, your hero is God himself. Okay? Here's what happens sometimes. We get lost. We don't see the forest because of the trees. Old cliche. We don't see the forest because of the trees. And what we'll do sometimes is we'll study the kings and we'll get bogged down in a lot of the incidentals about, you know, Saul's reign and his complex personality, or we might look at his relationship with David and we'll hear a lot of preaching about how to be faithful when you're struggling with others, you know, and all of that's good and fine, but we forget that the story itself is about what God is doing. It's about what God is doing to bring Jesus into the world. So we always have to look at whatever book we're studying, particularly in the Old Testament, through those lenses. Who's our key character? Who's our hero? Who's working here? Who's orchestrating? Who's carrying out this plan? Well, we might see David do his part or Moses do his part or whomever, but God is the one who's working and doing. Remember what Jesus said, I have been working, or my Father has been working, and I have been working until now, John 5:17. He's talking about salvation history. I think that we have to really keep that in mind, or we miss what it's all about. And that leads us to 1 Chronicles 22. Notice what happens here. Verse 6. Remember, David wanted to build a house for God. God said, you're not going to build it. I'll build you a house. And really, there's sort of a double idea taking place there. The house that God would build for David was a dynasty, not a literal building. But Solomon would build a literal building, which we refer to as the temple, which is a foreshadow of the incarnation of Christ and the church of Christ, believe it or not. Looking forward to something even greater, where God's presence would be even more dramatic. Okay? So what we find here in 1 Chronicles 22 is David made abundant preparations before his death, the Bible tells us there in verse 5. Abundant preparations how? For the building of this temple. He won't build it, but Solomon will. But notice verse 6, and this is important now. It says, then he called for his son who? Solomon. And charged him to build a house for the Lord God of Israel. And David said to Solomon, my son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, you have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to you. Now, in 2 Samuel 7, Nathan came to David and told him what God had in mind, that from his body would become a descendant who would sit on the throne. It's looking forward in its ultimate fulfillment to Jesus, but it's talking about his line. And so somebody needed to follow David in this line of kings. Who would it be? David didn't have just one son. He had several. And by the time Solomon is in a position to reign, he has a son that's older than Solomon. And generally, when a throne was succeeded, it would be succeeded by who? By the oldest son. At least the oldest living son. Notice verse 9. Behold, a son shall be born to you. This is what God told him, going back to 2 Samuel 7. Who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies all around. His name shall be, mark it, Solomon. For I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of the kingdom of his kingdom over Israel forever. So what does David say when he brings Solomon to him? You're the one, Solomon. And who told David he was the one? God did. So what do we see taking place here? God is working out his plan. What would his plan involve? It would involve a great nation, eventually over whom would be a king. But earthly kings were not really what God had in mind, although he used them and appointed them for the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. That's what all of this is about. But who does God have in mind? This is a plan that God fashioned even from the foundation of the world. And in God's mind, there was one choice, and who was it? In this case, for David's succession, Solomon. Okay? Hang on to that. Now let's go back. 1 Kings chapter 1. Uh-oh, I went backwards, as my dad used to say. First two chapters of 1 Kings act as an important bridge. Bridge between what? The careers of two extremely significant Old Testament kings. David's story, begun in 1 and 2 Samuel, ends here. While Solomon's begins, these chapters describe the transition of power from father to son. These chapters describe, looky here, we did a little double take on that. I guess I wanted to emphasize. Isn't it funny you can read over something and proofread, and if it's doubled like that, you don't catch it until the next day, which means you should always proofread once or work it and then go a couple days before you proofread. But that's neither here nor there. All right? So it's a period of transition. These first two chapters mark. And this sort of sums them both up. Verse 1, concern for succession. There is a concern in chapter 1. Who will follow David? Who did God say would follow David? Solomon. But there's concern. Why? Because there is a usurper. There is a usurper. Then in chapter 2, once Solomon rises to power and he's co-regent with David, and then even after David's death, we see concern for security. Once Solomon is enshrined as king, how can we make sure that his rule is not in jeopardy by his enemies? Okay? There's a passage in Proverbs that's interesting to me, and I think that it's true here. The text says, the heart of a man plans his way. That's true of all of us, don't we? You plan out your life, right? You say, I'm going to do this and this and this, if possible, or I'll go this direction or I'll go that direction. A man's heart plans his way. But then the writer of the proverb, chapter 16, verse 9 says, but the Lord directs his steps. The heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. What does that mean? That means in one sense, certainly we are free moral agents. What does that mean? We have free will. You can plan whatever in the world you want to plan. But on the other hand, Proverbs 16:9 declares, yes, man has free will, but God is absolutely sovereign. What does that mean? He's in control and he rules and he reigns. God has a will that cannot be thwarted. It's impossible for men to thwart. When they think they're thwarting it, that they're doing damage to it, God turns around and uses it for his own glory to bring about what he wants brought about. You can't outsmart God. He's always a step ahead. He can see down the stream of time and you can't. So what we find here is a wonderful blend of this idea. We see men using their free will to try to succeed on their own terms. We see other men coming to the rescue to try to stop those men from doing it. And no matter how hard those who are trying to thwart God's will try that very thing, and no matter how much goes into those who are in the process of keeping it from happening, all the while God is orchestrated. Nobody's free will is violated. But God uses all of those decisions and all of those circumstances and all of those events to bring things to pass. Who's going to sit on the throne after David? Solomon. Can men stop it? They can't stop it. At the same time, though, God doesn't rob them of their ability to try. He doesn't somehow puppeteer those who would seek to intercede and keep it from happening. Rather, he uses them. That may make your head roll and your eyes go back in their sockets, but we see a wonderful blend of the sovereignty of God and the free will of man in this text. So, okay, tell us why. All right, let's see what we got. First feller that we want to consider, and I do know it's fellow, and I do know that it's not backwards. The first fellow that we want to consider is Adonijah. Adonijah. He's the eldest brother at this time. You know, David had several sons. Some of them are already dead. One of them by the name of Keliab or Daniel. We don't even know what happened to him. He just kind of steps into the shadows. But based on being the eldest, you would think that the throne would pass to Adonijah, and he's convinced that it should. But what we find at the beginning is, well, don't get ahead of myself. Adonijah is an opportunist. Israel needs a leader, okay? But Adonijah is an opportunist. And it has always been the case that when there are pivotal moments in the history of a nation or the history of a church or the history of a kingdom, there are always those who are opportunists. Okay, you say, what does that mean? All right? Adonijah is an opportunist, verses 1 to 10. I like this. A real leader looks at a crisis and asks, what can I do that will best help the people? That's a good leader, isn't it? An opportunist looks at a crisis and asks, how can I use this situation to promote myself and get what I want? Opportunists usually show up uninvited, focus attention on themselves, and end up making the crisis worse. Adonijah was that kind of person. You ever seen a church that's in the middle of a great difficulty? And something needs to be done. Somebody needs to step up to the plate and take care of matters so that unity and harmony exist. And oftentimes there's that one or two persons who are walking about and promoting themselves and saying, if you'll allow me to take hold of the reins, I can change this. If you'll bring us into the fold of leadership, we'll put a stop to all this, and we'll make sure that what these other folks have been doing, finally done right. Right? And a lot of times what's happening is these types of people are nothing more than opportunists. They're not really looking to make the situation better. They just want the position. They just want the prestige. They just want the authority. They want the power. And what they often do, rather than helping the situation, they make it a lot worse. You've lived long enough, been in the church long enough, you've seen it, haven't you? Most of us have. So this is Adonijah. Here's what we have, the setting. The setting, 1 Kings chapter 1. Very interesting scenario here. We might wonder exactly why it's even recorded for us. Where David is seen as a very old man by this time, and he's infirmed. He's infirmed. And I like this word, and I put it just simply because I like it. David's decrepitude. Heavens to Murgatroyd. David's decrepitude. He's an old man. So first four verses, what's going on here? Verse 1 says, now King David was old and advanced in years, and they put covers on him, but he could not get warm. So he has a circulation problem, or so it seems. And notice the plan. Notice the medicinal remedy that's determined for the old king. Let a young woman, a virgin, be sought for our Lord the king, and let her stand before the king, and let her care for him, and let her lie in your bosom. A professional snuggler. That our Lord the king may be warm. So they sought a lovely young woman throughout all the territory of Israel and found Abishag the Shunammite, some versions may say Shulamite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very lovely, and she cared for the king and served him. Let's just stop right there. I want to mention something about Abishag the Shunammite or Shulamite. In the Song of Solomon, the king's bride is a young woman, a Shulamite or a Shunammite. It's talking about a particular region or area. And what we find is that some believe that the bride in the Song of Solomon is this woman who cares for David that Solomon would eventually marry. Can we prove that? Nope. Is it interesting? Does it make for good lore? Sure. But we can't prove it. But some have ventured the guess that maybe that's who's mentioned in the Song of Solomon. But notice at the end here, she serves him, but the king did not know her. He doesn't have sexual relations with her. Now, most commentators think, to go along with the protocol of the day, this wasn't just some woman who was brought in to sleep with David. She was made a concubine. And as you read through the text, that's true. Not that God ever put his stamp of approval on polygamy. But even when polygamy was oftentimes a general situation, there were certain protocol and rules that went along with it. A concubine was considered like a wife. There was the possibility of committing adultery even if you had concubines and wives. God never put his stamp of approval on that. From the very beginning, it was one man, one woman, and Jesus reiterated that. But oftentimes when you read the Old Testament, you find that God chose to bear up under particular social norms as he worked out his plan, looking forward to a time of greater responsibility, the New Testament, the coming of Jesus, the making clear of things in their highest order. Okay. But why this crazy, strange... Why do we need to know this? Some people think that the phrase "he did not know her" means that David, in his old age, he lost his virility. He's so old that a young, beautiful woman can't seem to even make a difference as far as he's concerned. Now then, here's what we might make the mistake of doing. We might try to take that section and preach some kind of sermon on David. I don't know how you do it. But there's a reason it's recorded. Why is it there? What's it trying to tell us as we enter in based on what we've already said so far? Trying to save his life? Sure. I think all of that's so. Let me suggest that the picture's being painted of how far David's fallen physically. Think about David throughout his life. What's he known for? Ruddy and good looking. He's courageous. He's strong. He's a warrior. He's valiant. He's the apex, the perfect man in a lot of ways. But how do we see him now? He's sick. Which means vulnerable. Did I hear that back there? No longer what? Fit to rule. Thank you. I didn't know if she said he can no longer hit the fool or spit a tool. Or I didn't know. Thank you, Caroline. My hearing. Good.
I think
we're on the verge of change. That's the idea. We're on the verge of change. If David is vulnerable, if he's not fit any longer physically, that means that we're stepping towards a transition. Okay? We're being alerted initially at the beginning. Now think about this. Who fits the picture of the other side of David's description? Notice. Notice verse 5. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. Remember, he's an opportunist. His father's sick. He's exerting his free will. He says, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not rebuked him at any time, saying, why have you done this? Notice this statement. He was very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. Now, the author's tipping us off to something. Who remembers Absalom? Absalom was David's good-looking, handsome son who tried to usurp the throne from him, beginning in 2 Samuel, about chapter 15 or so, going through chapter 18, and he was very good. We'll say more about that in a minute. He was a usurper. He was an opportunist. And so, don't think this comparison to Absalom, his brother, is by accident. Because Absalom was an opportunist and a usurper. So, what should that tell us is going to be true about Adonijah? He's no different. Then verse 7 says, then he conferred with Joab, we'll say who all these fellows are in a moment, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Re, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. Okay. Verse 9, his royal party, and Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fattened cattle by the stone of Zoelith, which is in Rogel. This area is very close to the city limits of Jerusalem. He also invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants, but he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the mighty man, or who? Solomon his brother. All right? Adonijah is an opportunist. Who's supposed to reign on this throne after David? Solomon. Okay? Solomon's supposed to reign. But who's trying to take advantage of this situation when the old man is sick and doesn't seem to be able to do anything and he's lost his virility and he doesn't seem fit to rule anymore? Who steps up and tries to take advantage of things? Adonijah does. But God's working. He's still the hero. God's still the planner. It's still his game. It's still his gig. Adonijah's doing what he wants to do because God's given us free will. And it's implied by not inviting Solomon, what did he know? He knew. In fact, we'll read, he'll admit later that he knew. What we have now are those. Well, let's do this. We've already seen the comparison Absalom and Adonijah. Regarding Absalom, now in all Israel there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when you read 2 Samuel, when David was on the throne, Absalom would stand at the city gate, people would bring their cases to be judged, he'd say, tell me about your case. He'd ask him where they were from, and he'd be very friendly, and he'd say, oh, you got a good case. If only I ruled over Israel, I'd fix it for you. You know what happened? He made promises to the people. He was friendly, and he slapped backs, and he shook hands, and he kissed babies, and he passed out cigars. And he put bumper stickers on people's chariots. And you know what? The people bought it hook, line, and sinker. We have the tendency to be sheep. We just follow whatever looks good or sounds good. I've used this before. Remember when, well, I don't remember, I wasn't born, but I've read about it. Richard Nixon ran against John F. Kennedy. They had a debate on television. And the polls were, you know, pretty neck and neck at the time. But in that debate, Nixon looked unshaven and a little bit unkempt. Whereas John F. Kennedy there with his striking looks and his dark hair and all of that. After that debate, much of which had to do with which politician, which candidate looked the best, things turned on a dime. And John F. Kennedy, it took off. We still fall for the suave. This is no indictment against Kennedy's presidency or anything like that. It's a whole other story. I'm just saying it just goes to show that we fall for the suave, debonair, the hip, the good-looking, the promise maker, over and against substance the majority of the time. Generally, as a whole, as a people. And it's always been that. It's always been that. So you have Absalom. He's good looking. He's an opportunist. We have Adonijah, his brother. He's a chip off that same block. And Adonijah now basically declares himself king. That's what this is all about. He's got Joab. We'll say who he is in just a minute. We don't have a lot of time. He's the military man, so he gets the military on his side. He gets Abiathar, he's high priest. He gets the religious elite on his side. And then he works on the people. Politically, religiously, socially, he's putting everything in place to win the hearts of the people and to ascend the throne. The Bible says that God rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he desires. Whomever he chooses. That ought to give us a lot of comfort in a lot of ways. Because even if someone ascends the throne or to a position of power who's not what he ought to be, is God unaware of it? Did somehow evil men thwart God's purpose, plan, or rule? No. Now, does that mean we just shouldn't care about the process and do nothing? No, because God also takes into consideration our decisions and what we choose to do to bring things into being. But if we do what's right and things don't turn out, at least in our own eyes, as we think they ought to, what should we do? Step back and think what? God's still in control. I'm still duty-bound based on my ability to choose and my own free will to do what's right. God doesn't strip me of that. Yes, His plan will prevail, but He may very well use me and you. And if that be the case, we better step up to the plate. We better step up to the plate. So, let's notice just a few folks here. The traitors. Traitor number one is Abiathar. Okay? Abiathar. Oh, there's just so much. So very much. When I read this right here, descendant of Eli. Be honest, how many know who Eli is? Show of hands. Got about four. Eli was the high priest during Samuel's day. Eli had sons, two in particular, Hophni and Phinehas. Anybody know what they did and what happened to them? They were disobedient, depraved individuals who should have been serving and ministering regarding the tabernacle with godliness and piety, but they were depraved and wicked. They had relations with the women who would come to the tabernacle. They took advantage of the worshipers and stole took what they weren't supposed to as far as their priestly portion. So many things. And it's interesting because Eli, their father, never rebuked them. And a prophet came to Eli and said, "You have honored," as he spoke on behalf of God, "your sons more than me." God said, "I'm going to cut off your family from the priesthood." In other words, the priesthood would run through Eli's family as long as he had descendants. But Eli did not harness his sons. His sons were wicked. And God said, I'm going to cut off your family from serving as a priest. That's all in 1 Samuel chapter 2. But Abiathar is a descendant of Eli. At one juncture, Saul gets angry with Ahimelech, who was the high priest. And he winds up slaughtering most all of the priests except one. One escapes. Who escaped? Abiathar escaped. He escaped. And he became David's man in that he would intercede on behalf of David before God. He was the one who would seek God for David. He inquired of the Lord on David's behalf. And here's it. He adhered to David in his wanderings while pursued by Saul. He was with him while he reigned in Hebron and afterwards in Jerusalem. He continued faithful to him. In other words, he was faithful all the while until David got sick. And it looked like Adonijah had the power to ascend to the throne, and he shifted his allegiance. Are you with me? You don't have to remember this. No test. He had always been loyal to David. And if he was loyal to David, he would be loyal to the Lord. And the Lord had chosen Solomon. But it seems to me that Abiathar saw how the wind was blowing. The next traitor is Joab. He was David's general. He was loyal to David mostly. And here's what I want us to notice. He defied David's orders and desires more than once, but what really ticked off David was he murdered Abner, Absalom, and Amasa, and I won't go into all of that. But these were men that David had a relationship with, had worked on terms of peace regarding at least one, and Joab killed them all. Not to mention, remember what David said about Absalom? He said, do no harm to the lad. Don't hurt him after Absalom tried to usurp the throne, and David's troops and men, his army, were on the verge of taking him. But what did Joab do? He killed him. He killed David's son. Now, you could argue maybe he should have, because Absalom was a threat. But generally speaking, he had been very committed to David. But now he sees how the wind is blowing. That leads us to verse 11, Nathan the loyalist, and we're not going to be able to talk about it. You see, there's some traitors in the midst. There's a threat to the throne. But God has a will. He has a plan. How's it going to be carried out? Hang on to that handout. You will need that handout to enter the pearly gates. Okay? So do not lose it.